You'll have to excuse me if I sound a bit sort of bunged up. It's because I am bunged up. I've got a bit of a cold. We'll see how we go. So there's a poem which I quite like, but I'm not going to read it to you. You can read it later in your own leisure. It's called Digging by Seamus Heaney. Mm-hmm. Have you anybody come across that one already?
Yep.
Okay. So maybe if you've got time at the end, I'll read it to you. But in the poem, he describes three generations, his grandfather, his father, and himself, as all digging in different ways. His grandfather digs the peat bog to earn a living, and he's very skilled at that. His father, he describes digging potatoes in the garden that he can see out of his window. And Seamus Heaney talks about digging himself using his pen. Yeah. So each of those three generations, he describes working in different ways in order to sustain themselves, I suppose, in different ways. But it's sort of metaphorical, of course, not literally. It's poetic. Anyway, in this description, he's describing them, his grandfather in particular, in a way that is perhaps a bit sort of romantic. You know, and we talk about it in terms of that kind of work has been an honest day's labour for an honest day's pay. And Seamus Heaney describes his own writing as his work, as his digging. That's the way he earns his money. Yeah? And, you know, throughout time, throughout history, where everybody has to somehow find a way of sustaining themselves, feeding themselves, or earning a living to do so. Yeah, we all have to get our potatoes or whatever. Yeah? But is it all honest? We talk about this, have this phrase, honest pay for an honest day's work. Is it all an honest living? Question. So here we are in the this fourth week, is it? Like fourth week of our exploration of the Buddha's Noble Eightfold Path. Yeah. And perhaps surprisingly, we have the Buddha talking about work being one of the conditions that can give rise to spiritual awakening. This spiritual awakening we call enlightenment. It's one of the conditions that are necessary as part of this Noble Eightfold Path. And it's perhaps surprising, after all, because the Buddha never did a stroke of work in his life. We might say, controversially. So there's some questions there. And what is right livelihood? Well, I'm going to answer that question in three sections of this talk. Three questions. Why does right livelihood feature in this Noble Eightfold Path of the Buddha? What does the tradition, our Buddhist tradition, have to say about this? And perhaps more importantly for ourselves, what relevance does this have to us living in the 21st century? What modern experiments, in right livelihood are taking place? And as the title of the talk is, Can Building with Lego Overcome the Ego? You can't see this, but there's a building of Lego. That's on the tape. So why does the right livelihood feature in the Noble Eightfold Path? So, coming out as it does after the initial spark of inspiration or even insight, right or even perfect livelihood is an aspect of the unfolding or the enacting, we might say, of this inspiration or insight into every aspect of our life. We spend a lot of our time perhaps too much time working. Even in the Buddha's time, people worked daily, even if they couldn't work for part of the year. For example, in India, you'd have a rainy season and the farmers wouldn't be working, couldn't work on the land during that time. So a bit more relaxed sort of time of year. But the majority of the time, people would be working, doing some sort of work. Even the Buddha's monks, who had left the so-called household life, might have had some sort of dealings with others that would, in today's terms, be called work. So everyone is up to it. And this activity that most people are engaged in does affect us. It moulds us. It moulds our minds in particular. And looking back over my own life, I've had quite a few different jobs so far. And looking back in the 1980s, early 1980s, I had two short-term jobs which affected me in different ways. One of my famous jobs I had was I worked for a week as a road sweeper. And I noticed that while I was doing this work, I'd become suddenly invisible. Yeah. No one spoke to me, not even my friends passed me in the street, which was kind of weird. Yeah. There you are, all dressed up in high visibility gear, but nobody, as it were, seemed to see me. It's like I had a magical cloak over me. But it was a bit weird, and that was weird and sort of kind of alienating. Yeah. I thought, yeah, it was really strange just to see how people related to me. It did affect me. And later on, I had a job as a relief postman, and that affected me in quite a different way. And what would happen is all sorts of things affected me in that job, particularly the dogs. Either they would attack me while I was cycling along, or sniffed me furtively as I opened my Hessian bag. But I did get used to dealing with these different dogs in different ways, and grew in my own confidence of dealing with my own canine status. Yeah. And because this was down in Cornwall, and part of my post round was quite sort of remote places I had to cycle to. And because I was the postman, I was quite a welcome sight for people. It was perhaps their only contact they had with another person for the week or whatever. So then, you know, a bit like the RAC man that comes out and fixes your car, they're a welcome sight, yeah? Mm-hmm. So I was a bit like that, being the relief postman. So I felt wanted and appreciated, yeah? And that was quite a different experience from the invisibility of being a road sweeper. So our jobs do affect us, don't they? Our jobs do affect us in different ways. And what we choose to do as a job, obviously, will have an implication on it. It will affect us in a different way. So the Buddha is aware of this, and he addresses this activity, aspect of our life. So what does the Buddha have to say, and what does the tradition have to say about livelihood? So there's quite a few stories in the Pali Canon, the original text, that are written down. And there's a couple I'm going to read you now about what the Buddha has to say about right livelihood. And the first is a nice little list you can find about the kinds of livelihoods that are, according to Buddha, to be avoided. Monks, a lay follower, that means somebody who's not a monk, the lay follower should not engage in five types of business. Which five? Business in weapons, business in human beings, business in meat, business in intoxicants, and business in poison. These are the five types of businesses that a lay follower should not engage in. Yeah, so the Buddha's saying what people shouldn't be doing. If they want to lead some kind of spiritual life, don't engage in these five types of business. Then he gives some advice to another one of his followers. About how to live. And now his follower is called Digajanu, who asks and says to the Buddha, "We are lay people enjoying sensuality, living crowded with spouses and children, using Kasi fabrics and sandalwood, wearing garlands, scents and creams, handling gold and silver. May the Blessed One," that's the Buddha, "teach the Dharma for those like us, for our happiness and well-being in this life, for our happiness and well-being in life to come." So you get the impression he's some kind of merchant. So the Buddha replies, I'll abbreviate this a little bit, "What does it mean to maintain one's livelihood in tune? There is a case where a layperson, knowing the income and outflow of his wealth, maintains a livelihood in tune, neither a spendthrift or a penny pincher. And he thinks, thus will my income exceed my outflow, and my outflow will not exceed my income. Just as when a weigher or his apprentice, when holding the scales, knows it has tipped down so much or has tipped up so much. In the same way, the lay person, knowing the income and outgoing of his wealth, maintains a livelihood in tune. And he's neither a spendthrift nor a penny pincher. Thus, will my income exceed my outflow, and my outflow will not exceed my income. If a layperson has a small income but maintains a grand livelihood, it will be rumoured of him, this clansman devours his wealth like a fruit tree eater. If a layperson has a large income but maintains a miserable livelihood, it will be rumoured of him, this clansman will die of starvation. But when a layperson, knowing the income and outflow of his wealth, maintains a livelihood in tune, neither a spendthrift nor a penny pincher, thinking, thus will my income exceed my outflow, and my outflow will not exceed my income. This is called maintaining one's livelihood in tune." So it's basic economics there, isn't it, really, his teaching? But also,
Mr. Micawber,
exactly. Basic economics. But also, when he's encouraging this lay person, this merchant, to be aware of how he operates his business and how it relates to his wider society, yeah? His reputation, if you like. Yeah?
So not creating bubbles.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay. There's another famous one that if you've read the talk by Sangharakshita on right livelihood, he mentions it as well. This is from the Taliputta Sutta, and Taliputta is an actor, and Taliputta goes to the Buddha and asks him his advice about his work. On occasion, the Blessed One was staying near Rajagaha in the bamboo grove, particularly the squirrel's sanctuary. Then Taliputta, the head of an acting troupe, went to see the Blessed One, and on arrival, having bowed down to him, sat to one side. As he was sitting there, he said to the Blessed One, "Lord, I have heard that it's been passed down by the ancient teaching lineage of actors that when an actor on the stage in the midst of a festival makes people laugh and give them delight with his imitation of reality, then, with the break of the body after death, he is reborn in the company of the laughing devas. What does the Blessed One have to say about that?" The Buddha replies, "Enough, headman, put that aside. Don't ask me." A second time, and a third time, Taliputta, the head of an acting troupe, said, "Lord, I've heard that it's said, it's been passed down from ancient teaching of lineage, when an actor on the stage in the midst of a festival makes people laugh and gives them a delight with his imitation of reality, then with the breaking up of the body after death, he is reborn in the company of the laughing devas. What does the Blessed One have to say about that?" So he's asked the Buddha three times. So it's very traditional that on the third time he does answer the question. "Apparently, headman, I haven't been able to get past you by saying, 'Enough, headman, put that aside. Don't ask me that.' So I will simply answer you. Any beings who are not devoid of passion to begin with, who are bound with a bond of passion, focus even more on passion, on things inspiring passion, than presented by an actor on stage in the midst of a festival. Any beings who are not devoid of aversion to begin with, who are bound by the bond of aversion, and those who focus even on more on aversion than on things inspiring aversion." So basically, whatever they do as an actor, exciting people with their anger and lust and all that kind of thing. "Thus the actor himself intoxicated and heedless, having made others intoxicated and heedless, with the break off of up of the body after death, is reborn in what is called the hell of laughter." But if he holds such a view as this, in inverted commas, "when an actor on the stage in the midst of a festival makes people laugh and gives them delight with his imitation of reality, then upon death he is reborn in the company of the laughing devas. That is his wrong view. Now there are two destinations for a person with this wrong view. I tell you, either hell or the animal womb." When this was said, Taliputta, the head of the action troops, sobbed and burst into tears. And the Blessed One said, the Buddha says, "That is what I couldn't get past you saying. Enough, headman, put aside, don't ask me that." Taliputta says, finally, "I'm not crying, Lord, because of what the Buddha has said to me, but simply because I have been deceived, cheated and fooled for a long time by that ancient teaching of the lineage of actors." So he's been misled by his tradition. He's very sad that he's been misled. So apparently being an actor is not where it's at, according to the Buddha. Yeah. But I think it's that the point of the story is more that not that acting per se is a bad thing, but the effect acting could have on other people. Yeah? Be aware of the effect you're having on others. And be aware of the kind of mental states you can get into, and what you cling to is going to be having an effect over time. So the Buddha gives these bits of advice, and throughout scriptures there are lots of examples of the Buddha talking to different people from different backgrounds and giving them advice about their life. And how they might practice in their own situation. Of course, he's also spending a lot of time talking to his monks, what we call monks, and his bands of wandering ascetics, or shramanas, as they were called in those times. And perhaps they didn't do any formal work, as far as we can tell. A lot of them went begging from door to door in order to get food. Yeah. And for most of the time, the society or the villages they went to visit, they could support them. But unfortunately, sometimes the band of the monks got so big they couldn't, a village they went to couldn't support them, so they were asked to move on to the next big town or whatever. So they didn't do any work as such. They did the begging in order to get their food. But to correct what I said earlier on, rather controversially, that they didn't do any work. Their work was teaching others, teaching people how to live a spiritual life. Yeah, and that was the Buddha's work in the sense that he went out travelling around northeast India, as it's called now. Helping people and teaching. Yeah. And today we would value that kind of teaching. People would be teaching today in the same way. And we might even say that this is perhaps this kind of teaching, this teaching work, is the purest kind of work you can be involved in. Yeah. Helping other people to help themselves to grow and develop. One of the things that's quite distinct about our movement, though, is that we don't have this sort of monk, sort of laity, sort of split. Yeah. So even though myself, I'm ordained, I don't live a monastic life. Yeah. I have a partner, I do a job. So the next question I'm going to answer is how do we go about having our life as a livelihood, a right livelihood, in the 21st century? And what relevance does the Buddha's teaching have today? So these days we have lots of choice in our jobs, perhaps. We have nice jobs, do we? They pay us well enough so we can have cars that can drive us thousands of miles down to the beach or whatever we want to do. We have all the technology to help us. And we can choose whatever work we want to do that's rewarding and enjoyable. Can we? I don't know. Perhaps not. Many of us have jobs that maybe they engage us, and we have to sort of focus on them, but are they enjoyable at the same time? And maybe our life is very busy and even stressful, yeah? And that stress can lead to all sorts of health problems. And we end up complaining about what we call our work-life balance, yeah? Now, I've just been reading this book called The Year of Living Danishly by Helen Russell. I don't know if anybody's heard about it.
Living what?
Danishly. Yeah, in Denmark. This lady goes to Denmark and a story about how she sort of finds out about things. Anyway, in this book, apparently, according to surveys, lots of surveys have been done, Denmark is the best place to work in the world if you want to live a happy life. The whole of Denmark, their society is geared towards a happy and a harmonious life. They pay high taxes and work a relatively short week. Yeah. All in order to get this balance right. Yeah. And education is free. They have a social and a national health service, the same as we do. And the pastries are great in Denmark, apparently. And this is where Lego comes in. This is Lego, this is something I built earlier. Lego is the world's biggest toy manufacturer. If you didn't already know. And it's Denmark's golden goose. But even in such an economic success as Lego, they run their headquarters in a particular sort of Danish sort of way. Their working day is from 8 o'clock in the morning to 4 o'clock in the afternoon, so that the people who work there can go and pick up their kids after work from school. And apparently there's no strict hierarchical structures. It's all quite relaxed in that sort of way. In fact, in Denmark, apparently showing off your status is a bit of a no-no. That's not the Danish way. They have fun at the workplace. And if you are experiencing any stress, etc., you are encouraged to talk to your supervisor.
You have to have fun.
They have to have fun, apparently.
Wow.
And they have very lots of traditions that encourage fun, apparently. So it's a caring working environment, we might say. And you can read about it more in the book, about how society like theirs can be progressive as well as environmentally and economically sound. So it's from a certain point of view, you might say this is right livelihood. Yeah, they're encouraging a healthy working environment for their workers, and they look after each other. So apparently nobody at the headquarters of Lego, anyway, is getting exploited. Of course, we can criticise Lego for other things. Their sexist kits they sell, and the Star Wars line is just promoting the military-industrial complex. But let's move on from Lego. So that's all very well, I would say, but the Buddhist view is one that's more radical even than this progressive working environment they might get at Lego. I would say our workplace can be somewhere that our path to insight can be at the forefront of our efforts. And it doesn't have to be at expense of making enough support for the workers even. And this movement that we're involved in, Tri Ratna, has perhaps been at the forefront of this new way of looking at work. But it's not the only way of working right livelihood in the Buddhist traditions that's going on now. Yeah. So I'm just going to explain a little bit about how we go about things in Tree Ratna, and what ideas that we've come up with, we've developed since the 1960s when Sangharakshita started our movement. First of all, it's an ethical environment. A place where we try and practice our five precepts. We've already done that in the previous weeks. You know, the five precepts of not harming, being generous, being kindly, etc., etc. So as well as this, we've developed this new principle which we call team-based right livelihood. Yeah. So that in the tradition you would have had, you know, what kind of livelihoods are right or wrong in terms of what you can and can't do. But we've developed this idea of working together in teams as a way of working. So people to come together in teams to run businesses. I've worked in a few. I've worked in health food stores, gift shops, a bookshop for a while. The centre here is a team-based right livelihood. Yeah. And the reason being that we've come together and decided to work in teams is that, well, it's hard working on your own, yeah? Working and developing on your own is hard, so it's very good to be working as a team to create what we're a supportive context. So, for example, we can, through helpful feedback, find out about how our practice of mindfulness is going. Yeah. Sometimes when we're working in a busy environment, we can look as though we're doing the right thing because we're busy. But perhaps we've forgotten to do the fundamental thing. You know, I've worked in shops. The fundamental thing in a shop and that kind of business is to be aware of and mindful of the customer. Yeah? That's where, in that context, you need to be focusing. I'm sure every business has its own sort of HR policy. Yeah? But does every business sort of encourage metta? Does it encourage sort of friendliness? In our businesses, that's what we try and remember to be doing. You know, it's explicit in our practicing of team-based right livelihood. And out of that practice of metta, you know, real friendships can develop based on respect for each other. And that's quite a different to have that explicit rather than, you know, the kind of atmosphere. Some of them, well, particularly at the moment, I'm working in quite a sort of macho environment. It's quite sort of difficult and it's not really supportive. But if you have that explicit environment where metta is at the forefront, it's a lot easier. Not saying it's not it's not always easy. Vilasamani and I have worked in business together. It's not always easy. Sometimes it can be challenging. Yeah. In a way, having our ethics at the forefront, having that ideal at the forefront, can be even more challenging than not, in a sense. Because there is that expectation to be sort of nice, as it were, all the time. And it can get into a sort of funny thing where sometimes people would beat each other up because they're not being nice enough, you know, which is a bit sort of counterproductive. Yeah? So it's not always a bed of roses, that's what I'm saying. It's not always a bed of roses. You know, we do fail, we make mistakes. But, you know, we move on. We try and progress step by step. and having metta in our practice can be fun as well, yeah? Metta isn't sort of just sort of seriously about sort of caring for people in a sort of heavy way, you know. Metta has this aspect of playfulness to it as well. So, for example, you know, we were working in an evolution shop, and it's fun unpacking 13 crates of wind chimes in a day, you know, having that sort of energy moving and enjoying it. Quite enjoyable. And it's fun, I found it was fun counting lots of money, you know. And it's fun smashing up old shelving units to make new way for new ones. Yeah. And it's great at the end of the day to sort of give all that away. You know, give all that money away, not to sort of hang on to it for our own selves, but to sort of give it away. And there can be a certain amount of pride in creating a successful team together and making money. But because it's a team thing, there's less of a sort of... your ego doesn't sort of attach to it so much. Yeah, you're sort of doing it together, so nobody sort of holds on to it and say, this is my success or whatever. It's sort of shared, and it's not so, as it were, ego-based. So, how does this working in a situation like this give rise to insight? How does team-based right livelihood give rise to insight? So, I think one of the things about the teams that I've worked in is that there's an objective demand. As well as having sort of the values, you are sort of in a situation where there is an objective demand for you to respond and do things. So how it worked on me was, one of my faults, perhaps I still suffer from this to some extent, is procrastination, yeah? Putting things off. But when there's this sort of objective situation, you have to move your energy, you have to sort of get things done. And it has sort of chipped away that habit that I had. And I remember being on retreat once where it was often, there was often a call for volunteers when you're on retreat to help out. With a washing up or something like that. And it was pointed out by the retreat leader that you could tell which people had been working in the businesses because they were always the first to volunteer. You just get on with it. Some things don't need reflecting on forever, and the washing up certainly isn't one of them. Just sort of get on and do it. And that's the... effect of working in this kind of objective, demanding situation. Working in a team also exposes to others who you are. Yeah. Who you are. Working in a team where there is an explicit ideal of sort of revealing yourself, helping each other, supporting each other to develop. And, you know, that can be quite humiliating in a sense, but in a positive way, yeah? Exposing yourself, working with people. Working in a team, you have a chance to build trust. So that when those moments of humiliation do come along, you're not destroyed by it. You have the friendship to sort of support and move on. Just a story from my own life. when I was ordained back in 1993, I was for a short while a bit sort of full of myself.
Shame.
Can't believe it. Yeah. I thought what I wanted to do and what I could do was be a great meditation teacher. However, my friends told me otherwise and told me my future in the short term would be best served if I worked in a whole food shop which I had in Bethnal Green. And this really shattered my dreams. I did feel humiliated, my dream was shattered. But at the same time, I did feel that my friends had my best interest at heart. And it felt like I was standing more in reality. I wasn't living in a sort of dream world. They were seeing me for who it was, so to speak. And that was really sort of heartwarming. I did sort of feel more connected with them and what who I really am, really. And I often think I have this little tussle with who I am and who my ego wants me to be. My ego says I'm the great guru. Excuse me. You know, I can be a bit like Pampasamvra, the Indian teacher who said, went to Tibet and converted to come to Buddhism. But in fact, that's not who I am. Yeah. I'm not a great leader or charismatic teacher or anything like that. I think it's probably true, and although it sounds a bit paradoxical, our practice actually helps us to be our true selves, yeah? We think we know who we are, but actually our practice can actually, it's in a sense, undermine that sort of ego and just allows you to be who you are. You're not sort of trying to be somebody else, trying to develop into some sort of superhuman being. You're being more who you are. Yeah. So who am I? I'm Sila Kirti. Another important aspect of team-based right livelihood is the practice of generosity. And this can come in a number of different forms. On a day-to-day basis, generosity can be the small things, like making tea for the rest of the team, or being the first person to arrive at work and getting the chairs out for the team meeting. And those seemingly small things, but they do make a difference in the running of the business, and they do help each other. But also our practices of generosity in the shops and businesses I've worked in, they help build, well, the centres that we've got here. You know, the centre we've got here mm-hmm. has come out of years of work we did down in Hammersmith. Yeah, we gave a lot of money so that the mortgage could be paid. Yeah. And, you know, that's building something amazing, building something with meaning, real meaning, and beautiful, yeah. More than the Lego model. Yeah. It's something really big, bigger than my own capability, bigger than my selfish interest. So the practice of generosity is, again, sort of undermines any sort of ego clinging, because you can't do it on your own. You can't build something like bigger like this. We do it as a collective, generous thing. So just to highlight again how practicing team-based right life could transform our egocentric tendencies. Firstly, it provides a supportive, explicit context for a practice of the precepts, for example, metta and mindfulness. It provides an objective demand that draws out qualities from us. It provides support for us to be who we truly are. And fourthly, it builds something bigger than my own self-interest. And there you are. That's a brief introduction to to Right Livelihood. How we do it in Sri Lanka.
Thank you very much, Silicon.
Thank you very much.